Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight. We have an hour left in our discussion with Mark Pilkington, author of the new book, Mirage Men. And I haven't asked him this question, but I'll bet I know part of the answer. And that is whether or not he is considered a disinformation agent, whether people think that he must be working with Rick Doty, that he's working with some government agency to discredit UFOs in general and sort of give them the brush off. And we can get into that and a lot more right after this. We'll be going to the phones with your questions on Coast to Coast AM. Before we go to the phones, Mark, one question, and it deals with your background. I'm sure you get, you're going to get a lot of people who say you're working with Doty, you're working with the government in light of the tack you take on a lot of UFO cases, and especially because of your background as a crop circle maker. Tell me just briefly about making crop circles. You think that they're all man-made?
Yeah, my sort of rule of thumb is that anything that, and even slightly more complicated than a misshapen blob, has been made by humans. But I should also say that several misshapen blobs have been made by humans as well. But yes, and anything that you see that has kind of signs of geometry or kind of complexity in it, I can assure listeners is human made, which doesn't diminish the fascination with the phenomena. In any way, as far as I'm concerned, I think it makes
what,
it all
yeah,
more
what drives people to go out there and do it?
Yeah, and also I think, you know, the real art is in the way people respond to the formations, and I think that's magical and truly mysterious. You know, people claim all sorts of bizarre and wonderful sort of responses to the formations. And,
well, tell me this: how do you make the ones where the crop seems to be weaved as opposed to just crushed down?
I saw that done last year, and it was it's impressive. What you would do is kind of push. You'd be basically weaving the crop, pushing it from one side to the other in a different direction with each step, because what you're doing is sort of flattening the wheat or crop with a plank of wood. So you'd just push to one side, then to another, and that would create a kind of weave as you went along. So that's actually a nice. New direction, I think, in the kind of artistry of the formations.
Oh, I don't know. That's been around a long time. That's the one I couldn't. I mean, you could dispute the evidence about high heat and radiation and microwaves and all that stuff, but the weaving part doesn't seem like something you could do with a board. At least, you know, I was over there in the 90s and saw a couple of the fields that thought, wow, that's pretty hard to do with a board.
Yeah. Do you mean the sort of twisted weave?
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, you would do that by hand, manually, by twisting, or you would kind of create a tight circle with, you know, kind of rotate into a tighter circle at the center, so things kind of get tighter as you approach the front. If I was, if you were here with me, I could demonstrate it if we were of wheat. But.
Understandably, since you have that background and you're doing that stuff, and I guess some of it could be considered crimes, I guess, or at least certainly misleading of the public, and I can see where you're heading, you know, how it could be an interesting experiment, but because you've done that in your background and now you're writing this book, there you're going to have people saying that you're working with the evil forces, aren't you?
Yeah, it was sort of an inevitability, and it certainly already happened, and even before the book was out, I was up on a web page, my photograph along with that of John Lundberg and several of our associates as kind of people working with the British intelligence services to discredit belief in UFOs, but I can assure listeners that I'm still waiting for my paycheck. If I was if I have ever worked unwittingly for them, I haven't been aware of it thus far.
Well, maybe Rick Doty will break out the serious money for you.
I'm looking forward to it.
We're going to open the phone lines. I had sent an email earlier to Mark Allen, who created and founded Above Top Secret. He has not read your book yet. Mark, you there?
I am here.
Mark, meet Mark. Mark Allen, I don't think Mark Pilkington is trashing ATS. He just thought it was kind of a coincidence, that the timing.
Yeah. Let me set something straight right off the bat. I did not found or create ATS.
Okay.
That was Simon Gray, and I certainly am one of the owners, but I did not found it or create it.
Okay.
Pleasure to meet you, Mark.
Hi, Mark. Yeah, good to hear from you. No, I'm not accusing it above top secret of being a government front, I think. But I would, you know, I would suggest, and I do suggest that it would be a useful place for, you know, for the intelligence community to watch if they were interested in what people are interested in.
Yeah, and that's fairly obvious. My biggest question for you, Mark, is, you know, I have gone out since George emailed me, and I've read certain snippets of your book. Mm-hmm. But my biggest question is, why did you never reach out to myself or my partners before you wrote it and just send us an email and say, hey, guys, here's what I think, you know? Were you behind Serpo? Did you support Serpo? Mm. And the reason I ask that is because, you know, AboveTopSecret.com was the site that, through our users all over the world, literally debunked Serpo. And the other two forums that you mentioned were created by members of AboveTopSecret.com.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of astounding to me.
I'm not totally sure what you're saying, but I did actually make contact with somebody from Above Top Secret who I spoke to in early 2006. I can't remember now who that was, but I didn't see, to be honest, I didn't see that Above Top Secret was doing anything other than reflecting interest that was already out there in the story, and it was Bill Ryan's site that, you know, we followed Bill because he was the person who was pushing the Serpo material through his own website, serpo.org.
So. Right, and it was on our site that all the questionable, or shall we say, self-conflicting points that Bill Ryan came up with were brought up. Mm-hmm. Brought out, and I just found it interesting after reading the snippets from your book, mm-hmm, that what you wrote just seems in direct conflict with reality, and it just astounds me that you never, and I don't mean that in a bad way, man, you know, you're writing a book, you're doing the research on some crazy stuff, I get that, but we always wonder why nobody ever just calls us or emails us and asks us.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view and the things I was pursuing, it didn't, to be honest, Above Top Secret wasn't kind of, I mentioned it in passing just as one of the sites that sprang up kind of in the wake of the resurgence of interest in the UFO subject that Serpo helped to bring on, but I didn't have any further kind of, I don't talk about the site beyond that, I didn't have
a
further involvement with it.
Yeah, Mark, Alan, I tell you from reading the book today that it's just mentioned a couple times in passing. But now that you guys are pals on the air, maybe you could. I'm sure that this topic is going to come up on ATS, so maybe you can work something out with Mark.
Yeah, sure.
Without question, Mark. Beyond the slight, and I do mean very slight, disagreement that I have with you on that one point, everything else you said I've really enjoyed.
Great.
And get with George or the Coast to Coast people, get my email. I would love to hook up with you. And,
yeah, likewise. That'd be great.
Let's do some work together.
Yeah, for sure. Great.
Okay. Right. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, George.
East of the Rockies, Elaine in Pennsylvania. Hi, Elaine.
I've been wanting to call for a while.
Here you are.
Okay. It was like a little better than 3 years ago. I was on a cruise ship going through the Caribbean, and I was in the vicinity of the Bermuda Triangle. And I went out in the balcony, and I was, like, facing the back of the ship. And I noticed that there was, like, a cluster of stars, like a round cluster. And I'm looking at it and thinking, what is that, you know? And before long, it started to turn. And about the 3 o'clock position, they start to separate, and they flew away. They flew out of my sight, like towards the other side of the ship, and that was it. If I would have ran over across the ship, maybe I would have been able to see more, but it was just very strange, and I wanted to share that with you.
Oh, thanks, Elaine. That's a really classic UFO sighting, and it remains a UFO. I don't think we can say from our vantage point what that was or might have been. But it sounds like an amazing sighting for you.
Wish I could have one. Thanks, Elaine. Thanks for the call. West of the Rockies, Jerry in Los Angeles. Good morning, Jerry.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, I'd like to ask, why don't UFOs from other planets ever stay landed long enough to meet the public, Channel 2, Channel 4, the mayor? My theory is that they haven't been here yet. Maybe tomorrow they'll stop by, but they haven't been here. That's my theory.
Yeah, I think that's a very a wise approach. I think I would agree with you with that. And I would also think if the ETs had been here or have been here as long as some people think that they have, then they would obviously be sort of firmly plugged into what's going on with the developments in media. So if they wanted to present themselves to us, then they would have done by now, but perhaps they don't want to. So.
But yeah, it's hard. It's hard to figure out the motives of people we don't even know who they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we can only hope that when the time comes, they will, they will show themselves to us if that's indeed what they want to do. But they've certainly made a great impact on the kind of popular culture and on the popular consciousness through all their fictional representations. And these are very influential in the way that people think about and imagine the UFO story and the UFO phenomenon to be.
Tell me this, Mark. Do you think that Rick Doty is still working for someone or doing their bidding, whether he's actually on the payroll or not, or whether he keeps a hand in it just for the heck of it, just to mess with people and have fun?
Yeah, I can't answer that question. I genuinely don't know. I know that Rick, like all of us, Rick is I think genuinely interested in the wider UFO story and the phenomenon, but I don't know if that's a professional interest or a private interest. Certainly, he told us repeatedly that he was a private citizen and had no kind of official role to play in that story. And we can't I can't offer any more than that, I'm afraid. I think he's sort of off the trail now. He's out of contact at the moment. So.
Well, we've tried to get him on, as I mentioned earlier, a couple of times on the program, and he's initially indicated, yeah, he'd do it, and then he sort of changes his mind. I think he goes back and forth between what he wants to jump into this fire again or not, and probably he's been beaten up and had all kinds of personal repercussions because of his involvement in the field.
I'm sure, and all I can hope, is that Rick's busy writing his memoirs, and one day, we'll get to read them. I'd be happy to publish them.
Well, I'm in the same boat with you, is that I feel that there's a lot that Doty could still say about this mystery that could shed so much light on it, because whether it's disinformation or not, he's been in an interesting spot for a very long time.
Absolutely.
And what I found interesting, and you mentioned it in your book, is that there's a family connection, that he's not the first person in his family to be involved in this sort of thing.
Yeah, it was his uncle Ed, I think, who actually shut down Project Twinkle back in, 49, I think, that he shut it down, which was the an early research project to look into the mystery of the green fireballs that were being seen by all sorts of people over New Mexico, and particularly around the White Sands missile training and testing area. And there was actually a kind of pretty high-powered research team kind of working on this mystery, on this phenomenon, and it was actually Rick Doty's uncle who kind of brought the investigation, the project, to a close. So yes, the UFOs are in the bloodstream.
Did you have a chance to ask him about Uncle Ed?
Yeah, sure. And we asked him whether. I remember one of the things that Rick told us was that he actually, as a kid, had no interest in the subject, but he told us that his brother did, and he used to make fun of his brother for it. If his uncle, the sort of impression I get from historically is that his uncle, didn't actually believe there was any kind of extraterrestrial involvement with the UFO story. Certainly, when closing down Project Twinkle was a administrative decision rather than a sort of research based one, as far as I can assess.
Okay, we're going to our international line, Marie in Toronto. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning. I think UFOs are all a government hoax, and I wanted to ask your guest, about a month ago, they had a guest on, and somebody called in and said that they had read that after the war, when they took down Hitler, they found a flying saucer in one of those underground mountains at the border of Switzerland. And I forget what book it was in, but he knew all about it. And I was wondering if your guest had or knew anything about that.
Well, Marie, you've just opened a huge can of giant worms. That's a whole other series of books and sort of conversations. But certainly there are stories that the Germans at the end of World War II were sort of developing advanced vertical takeoff and landing sort of forms for their aircraft. And one of the things I do sort of talk about this a bit in the book, and one of the things I try to show is that the flying saucer or disc in itself is not, there's nothing alien or, you know, or unusual about that as a form for an aircraft. In fact, people were flying round-winged aircraft as far back as the 1930s. I have a picture of one in the book. So, the idea that if it's a flying disc, it has to be alien is one that emerged kind of through the 1950s, and as I believe the kind of idea that flying discs were ET craft was kind of promoted by people within the sort of intelligence and security organizations. It's a real tough, tricky, convoluted subject, but there were press reports in the European press in the early 1950s suggesting that what people were seeing as flying saucers were experimental disc-shaped human aircraft, and certainly the U.S. Air Force, in conjunction with a British designer, John Frost, in the mid-1950s, did work to develop a classic flying saucer in a project called Project Silverbug, and the kind of paper trail ends, I think, in late 1956 with discussion of wind tunnel and flight test, but there it sort of disappears, and that's all we know. So it's possible, it's certainly possible that they had something that flew. And certainly we shouldn't forget the lovely flying flapjack, which was a Navy aircraft from that was developed through the 40s, and a couple of prototypes flew in 1947. And these, from a distance, certainly would look quite saucer-like. And there were also rumors. Sorry.
Yeah, I know there were a lot of programs, the Avro car, mm-hmm. things that look like flying saucers that are flying around doesn't seem like they could perform the kind of maneuvers that people have been seeing UFOs allegedly perform for a long time, though.
No, I'd agree with you with that. And actually, one of the possibilities is that there were also early unmanned vehicles that were saucer-shaped. A well-known one is called Piwacket, guided missile developed in the 60s. But,
well, if we've got them and we can fly them and they can do these amazing things, sure would like to see one of them one of these days. Stay mm-hmm. with us. More of your questions for my guest, Mark Pilkington, after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Mark Pilkington, author of Mirage Men, An Adventure into Paranoia, Espionage, Psychological Warfare, and UFOs. We have one segment left, and we're going to the phone. Stay with us. Thanks for being with us tonight, everyone. Your questions for Mark Pilkington, author of Mirage Men, East of the Rockies, Russ in Ohio. Good morning, Russ.
Good morning. How you doing, George?
Okay. What's on your mind?
I'd like to ask Mark, out of all the different people that he was talking about, that talked about UFOs, underground bases and that, why did he never mention William Cooper?
Hi, Russ. why I didn't mention, I think I mentioned him in passing, but, you know, he certainly, I know his story, and I have his book here, actually, Behold a Pale Horse, but he kind of came in the sort of tail end of the 80s and was just sort of one of many figures that was spreading and the sort of stories that I think have their roots in the material presented and broadcast by Paul Benowitz. So I think I can't remember. I may mention him by name in the book, but he's an interesting and complicated figure who, you know, probably deserves a whole book of his own. But I can't fit, you know, everyone into one book, I'm afraid. Is he someone you're interested in? Oh.
Yeah, Russ, is there something you wanted to say about Bill Cooper? I think Russ is gone. I had some. Are you there? He's gone. I had some encounters with Bill Cooper. He certainly was a vigorous defender of his stories, but they became a lot more elaborate over the years. The first time I did the first TV interview with him, and he came on and he said, "I'm telling this story once, and then I'm going away." And then a couple months later, he's charging people $50 a head to have dinner with him, and those people who crossed him, who criticized him, found themselves on the secret list of government agents. And he was an interesting man.
Happens to the best of us, but this is something we see is how the stories with a lot of these sort of informants and whistleblowers and insiders, the stories just get more and more complicated as time passes and grow more kind of more amazing and more spectacular over the years.
Well, as I'm sure you know, Jacques Vallée may be the first guy to write about disinformation and deception on the part of governments who use the UFO story for their own ends in a book called Messengers of Deception, which is a classic. And I remember, I wasn't around then, but I remember reading about the reception within ufology. It was pretty negative.
I wouldn't be surprised. And yes, I'm extremely familiar with that book. It's one of my sort of real favorites, and actually was one of the kind of touchstones for writing and developing Mirage Men. But yes, I mean, I think people... You know, you hold a mirror up to a community or to people, and sometimes they don't like, what's reflected in there. And one of the things that just always has amazed me, particularly partly with Jacques Vallée's book, but also with William Moore's kind of exposure, and he, you know, presented himself in 1989 as a kind of double agent for AFOSI, and yet most people just preferred not to listen to what he had to say and continue to spread the same stories and tell the same stories and follow the same path without really taking into account the ramifications of what he was saying. And I think it sort of doesn't reflect too well in some ways on the UFO community that these issues are still largely ignored, although I think they've been certainly discussed a lot more. Greg Bishop's excellent book, Project Beta, for example, sort of brought these out into the open a few years ago. But, I think this is a really key area of research and investigation for anyone interested in the UFO subject. And I would suggest looking back at the very early days of the story back into the late 40s and early 50s. I think that's where the real kind of... surprises and secrets might lie.
Well, Bill Moore was a really sharp guy. I got to spend a little time with him and interviewed him and picked his brain. And I think the topic is lesser for not having him in it, but he kept to his word and turned his back on it. And I think a lot of people just never got beyond the idea that they felt that he'd betrayed them, that he was spying and passing information. And, you know, and rightfully so, they can be mad about that. I understand what he was trying to do, but I can understand also why people were angry with him.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it was very brave of him to come forward. Obviously, this is something that he'd agonized over himself, and I'm sure he had many a sleepless night kind of, you know, wondering whether he was doing the right thing. And I'm very sorry we never got to speak to Bill. He was the only person that we didn't manage to talk to who, as you say, has just sort of opted out of the subject and didn't want to kind of be brought back into it in any way again, which I can understand. But
well, I'm sure it like took a 12-step process to get it out of his system. Back to the phones. Wildcard line, Michael in Albany, New York. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. What's on your mind?
Michael. You have a very interesting topic. Unfortunately, I only listen to parts of it because I'm a taxi driver. I happen to have seen various types of UFOs and encountered an experience where one of my passengers, while I was driving from Albany to Clifton Park to the Half Moon, he hadn't paid me at the moment, and he was expected to pay me when he arrived at his destination. And there was a message that came through from a UFO, and it was mental. It told me he was not going to pay. So I took that moment to ask him for confirmation of credit cards and a cell phone and such. And 6 months later, after he had failed to pay me, he was arrested for trying to use one of those credit cards. But I never would have asked him.
And hey, Michael, let me back up on this. You said the message came through from a UFO. How do you know that? This message popped into your head and it was from a UFO that this guy wasn't going to pay you?
Yes. The UFO was like a, you know those pops that we used to throw? We used to wind a string. It was kind of triangular and it would spin when you threw it. And on the point, it was a little steel point. And, well, this one was knurled and silver in color, and it was flying through the clouds, not super fast, but certainly moving like a Piper Cub speed. And as it did, I pointed it out to him, and he just looked... he couldn't make out what it was other than it was something he hadn't seen. But I was receiving the communication at that moment from it.
Well, so that's great to hear that the UFOs are looking out for your security and warning you, who's going to rip you off. You should thank them for that at the very least.
Yeah, Michael, thanks for the call. I wish they had given you more information, more useful information than that, like some stock market tips. And I'm not making fun of you on that, but it's because the weird stuff like that happens. It pops up in the lore of ufology, that's for sure. Jim in Chicago on a wild card line. Hi, Jim. How you doing?
Pretty good, George. I think I'll use that UFO excuse next time I order a pizza. But anyway, I think one of your previous callers might have been talking about the Nazi bell, and that has to do with my question to Mark about the Kecksburg case.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you have any information on that?
I know the case, and I know I've read about it, but I don't have any fresh knowledge or information about it. It struck me as it's one of these stories that's kind of grown more kind of complicated and sort of grown strange new appendages and sort of limbs and organs over time. And I don't have anything sort of particular to say other than I would look at it, certainly look at the possibility that it was some kind of downed aircraft or a satellite or something, which I know has been, it's one of the sort of avenues that has been explored. But yeah, sorry, I can't offer you anything on that.
Anything else, Jim?
Yeah, you know, what interests me is the shape. We're talking about the Nazi bell in the 40s. The Kecksburg, I believe, is like 65, something like that. Let's go back 2,000, 3,000 years to the Indian Vedic text. Mm-hmm. It's identical to the Rukma Vermana. So that's going to take a lot of disinformation to wipe out 3,000 years of sightings.
Yeah, and one of the fascinating things, you know, about the UFO subject is the way that you can find echoes or sort of, you know, precursors of it all the way through human history or human recorded history. And, you know, these things, they're kind of part of our historical and sort of imaginal makeup, I think. I think they're always there, and we can interpret them, you know, in multiple different ways depending on on what we know and what we understand in our time. But yes, the stories of the Vimanas are really fascinating, certainly, and do have curious echoes of the contemporary UFO report.
Thanks for the call, Jim. I should mention that we talked earlier about Jacques Vallée. I know that his next book project coming out, I think, next month, is about older UFO cases, pre-World War II UFO cases, maybe pre-20th century cases,
yes.
Before there was a CIA creating disinformation, before there were airplanes and dirigibles and things like that, which, you know, you have to take them with a grain of salt, I guess, the cases. But they're very similar to the kinds of things that people see now.
Yeah.
Minus the kinds of explanations that are used to explain them away.
Yeah, I have the book here, actually, an advanced copy, Wonders in the Sky.
Right.
Can highly recommend it. So.
Yeah.
But you have to look at these cases within, you know, the historical context in which they were presented, and of course Jacques Vallée and Chris Holbeck, the authors, do. And, you know, they weren't without political spin and a certain aspect of, you know, political and kind of contagion, I suppose. That's not too strong a word, in that they would often be used to kind of push particular messages of kind of good or bad omens or portents for, you know, for a culture or for a
religion.
A society or a religion, exactly. So.
Sure.
Yeah, we have to consider that at all times.
Yeah, Polly in Texas, how you doing, Polly?
Hello.
Hello. Hey, how you doing?
Oh, great. Thank you. This is a great program. I wanted to bring up just two points. I was pondering, looking at a book written by it was called Secret Armies, and. What's to say that black op technologies are so advanced that the government has the ability to manipulate projection of lights, similar to, you know, how you take a pen light, you're doing a presentation, and, mm-hmm. you know, they're talking about these lights, you know, speeding so fast, you know, and it was just kind of interesting that, you know, how they describe how the sightings, you know, they just happen to break into different you know, segments, and then they fly off. And
sure.
Then also, with the sophistication of electromagnetics and other, you know, microwave technologies, what's to say that they can't disable or close off the conscious minds of people that are considered abducted,
mm-hmm.
and to basically study, you know, the implanting of false memories or maybe these little metal components that, you know, people are having to have extracted from their bodies. I was just wondering what your take would be on that, and I'll hang up.
Yeah.
And listen. Thanks.
I'm right with you on this idea that, you know, advanced technologies or advanced aircraft might well represent a good portion of previously sort of unknown or unidentified sightings of craft. And it's interesting you talked about sort of the use of lights, and back in the even as far back as the 70s, people were talking about the use of sort of holographic images, and even back in the First World War, there are reports of armies using projectors to project images onto clouds to kind of deceive their enemies. So you know these. These tools for deception are very, you know, I think are certainly part of any arsenal, and psychological warfare is a key component of any kind of engagement these days. Another thing is when we, while sort of fireballs, naturally occurring fireballs can do things like split into multiple fragments, I've often wondered if sometimes, you know, this would be a useful form of kind of chaff or a useful decoy. If you've got an aircraft, you could fire some kind of brightly lit object away from you that would distract attention in another direction. And there was, back in the 50s, a missile-borne magnesium flare called the Hell Roarer, which was tested. And when it was tested, I think it was as early as 1951, I can't remember exactly, it created a wide sort of spread of UFO reports. to appear in the press in the areas where it was being test flown. And I'm sure even if it wasn't the intention to generate UFO reports, once the Air Force realized that this is what happened, it may well have proved something that they would deploy at a later date. So yeah, I think you're definitely on the right track there.
Good point, Polly. And, you know, here in Nevada, Area 51, home to the U-2 and the SR-71, I know the CIA had issued a report a few years ago that, a heck of a lot of UFO sightings must be the result of these kind of craft, which I'm sure some of them might be that way. But I don't know how anyone could say a U-2 looks like a flying saucer. Plus, especially the SR-71 flying at such high altitudes, I don't know who sees it up there, you know. But I know it was useful for, it was an easy way to explain away a lot of UFO sightings in one fell swoop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think your mention of the SR-71, I mean, it would be other pilots, I suppose, who might see this thing kind of zip past at seemingly impossible speeds. Yeah, certainly. The Air Force and the CIA have said that some of their advanced and secret craft certainly were behind some UFO incident.
Hey, Mark, we have just about a minute left. Tell me about your film project. I know there was a film project you were working on in association with the book, and you've got Rick Doty on camera, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Mirage Men sort of began as both a book and a film project, and John Lundberg and I interviewed everybody who appears in the book, and we've got all this amazing footage on camera, and we ran out of money and haven't been able to assemble it. Although, you know, and we're certainly very keen to hear from anybody who might be able to help us, but. We hope to put this material sort of edit it into shape sometime soon. But it's out there, the material sort of in hand. It's beautifully shot. We use professional cinematographers, and it's really fascinating stuff.
But Doty sat down for an on-camera interview.
Oh yeah, yeah. We have at least a couple of hours of interview with Rick Doty and several other characters in the story. So,
well, yeah. That would be worth the price of admission.
Yeah, well, yeah. if someone's really keen to see it, then we've got it all. We've got it all here. We've shown it. We've actually shown some of the interview footage with Rick at a couple of kind of gatherings and conferences here in the UK, but never outside there. And some people in the U.S. have seen it. We've given copies to a couple of people.
So are you still in contact with him? I mean, can you call him up? And did you tell him you were going to be on the show?
No. The last I heard from Rick was at the beginning of this year, and actually the final email I had from him I include at the end of the book. But he's sort of gone quiet as far as our communications are concerned. I've heard from other people that he's not talking to people about UFOs at the moment.
Do you have any suspicion that it's somebody told him, hey, shut the hell up, you've made too much noise already?
It's possible, yeah. I'd say that's possible. Yeah, he's been, it could be that he's been sort of advised to keep quiet. Hey,
all right, Mark, thank you very much. Your book is called Mirage Men, An Adventure into Paranoia, Espionage, Psychological Warfare, and UFOs. Very interesting stuff. Hope you enjoyed your interview here, and hope you'll come back sometime.
Thanks very much, George. Cheers.
Thanks very much. Thanks, as always, to Jason and Gina and Tim there at Premier. Also to my earlier guests, Steve Hammonds and Mark Allen, who called in. I'll be back next month, everyone. Good night.